For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. When you have an empire, you get wars without enemies and criminals in charge of enforcing the law. That's just the way it works. And it's really kind of an amazing story. This poor lady was in the wrong place at the wrong time. After September 11th, she was an immigrant, a patriotic American citizen, immigrant to this country, who decided she would go and get a job at the FBI helping them translate foreign languages in their counterterrorism section. And she just so happened to stumble across something near the core of the crime syndicate that controls the United States of America. Of course, this woman's name is Sybelle Edmonds, and she's got a gag order, and she can say some things that have already been revealed one way or another. She can kind of reiterate them, but has never really been able to tell her full story in public. And the story's always been of interest to me, but it's so complicated and convoluted that I always have a hard time keeping up and making sense of the story. So I always turn to my friend Luke Ryland. He writes the great blog, What Is It Good For? W-O-T for What Is It Good For? .blogspot.com. And he's basically my walking crib sheet for cheating on the Sybelle Edmonds test and keeping track of this story. So welcome to the show, Luke.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be here.
It's good to talk to you, my friend. And just so everybody knows, I think it's cool. I'm on the phone with Tasmania right now. Luke lives on a little island on the bottom of the earth where he keeps track of the criminality of American politicians so that you don't have to, I guess.
It's a long way from you guys, that's for sure.
I guess let's start with, you know, the basics of the Sybelle Edmonds story. As I said, she's an immigrant, an American citizen, who after September 11th decided that she would be a patriot and would go to the FBI and get a job being a translator. She speaks, Farsi and Azerbaijani and Turkish and a few other languages at least. And she went to go and be a patriotic American citizen and do her duty. And as a result, her whole world got turned upside down. Luke, what happened?
That's right, Scott. So she started working at the FBI the week after September 11th. She'd actually had an application into work in a different department for them that she'd applied, I think, 2 years earlier, and they had lost her application. After September 11th, they must have run a new check, and they found that they had that Sybelle's application was there, and it had three languages on it, three non-English languages, as you say, Turkish, Azerbaijani, and Farsi. And they thought she'd be pretty helpful in the, you know, in the translation unit in Washington to help them sort through a backlog of stuff that they had built up over the, you know, over the time. So she started there, I think, whenever it was, the 14th of September or thereabouts. And before long, she realised that there was a whole bunch of shenanigans going on in the translation department, including, you know, mistranslations and intentionally. Translations that were intentionally being falsified to cover up a whole bunch of different criminal activity. It wasn't long before that, I think in early December, when one of her fellow translators knocked on her door on a Sunday morning and with her husband and tried to recruit her into basically to be a spy for certain criminal networks.
And now this was the infamous Melik Can Dickerson, right? Who was this lady?
She was married to, in fact, he's married to a guy called Major Douglas Dickerson. Or he might have got a promotion. I think he's had a promotion since then, whatever the next level up. He's an Air Force major who'd been involved in weapons procurement in Turkey going back a decade. So the two of them turned up and tried to recruit Sybelle, her husband. Sybelle's husband was there as well. And they were just having a friendly chat, and all of a sudden Major Douglas Dickerson said, oh, why don't you come and join this organization, the American Turkish Council? and basically said, you know, if you come and if you work for these guys, we'll be able to get you in there, and you'll never have to work again. Basically, trying to recruit Savelle to, you know, either mistranslate documents that were incriminating, or you know, steal other documents that were in the building and feed them out to the targets of the investigation, so they knew where the investigation was going.
And so, now this lady, Melikan Dickerson, was really giving Savelle Edmonds problems in the translation unit. Is that correct?
I don't know that specifically. I don't know whether that happened before this point or only after that point. I think, you know, Savelle rebuffed the espionage recruiting attempt, and then reported it to her boss 1 or 2 days later.
Who's her boss at the FBI that she reported this to?
Savelle's boss is a guy called Mike Fagali. He was in charge at that time of the Turkish desk only, I think. Melikan Dickerson was also Turkish. She actually joined the FBI after Savelle had. Savelle was actually the first Turkish translator, first and only Turkish translator in the FBI translation unit when she first joined. They didn't have anyone else there.
They didn't have anyone?
Nope. They recruited Savelle, and then they recruited this Melikan Dickerson, and then another guy, Kevin Takerson, I think his name is. Turns out Melikan Dickerson was a spy, and Kevin Takerson could speak neither Turkish nor English. So it was just a disaster, the FBI field office there in Washington.
And now, what is this American-Turkish Council that they tried to recruit Savelle Edmonds to join?
The ATC is the American-Turkish Council. It's basically a mini AIPAC. In fact, it was set up using the AIPAC model, I believe. And had the same people on the boards, you know, they had common members, etc. So it was basically the Turkish version of AIPAC, the Israeli lobby. The people on the board there, the ATC was basically, as Savelle says, it was an association in name and in charter only. She said the reality is that it, the ATC, other affiliated associations, are the U.S. government, lobbyists, foreign agents, and the military industrial complex. So you've got guys, you know, the board members include people like the CEO of Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, I presume, I'm not sure. So it's basically a lobbying group for the military industrial complex.
I see, and there's a lot of common interests there. You can see the, I guess what they have, what they call the Iron Triangle, or the revolving door where the politicians get jobs working at the firms, and the regulators and the lobbyists, and they all go back and forth in these little circles. And also internationally, you know, you keep bringing up Turkey here and the American-Turkish Council. It makes sense when you think of the fact that America has been a NATO ally with Turkey really since World War II, and has armed them and supplied them all along, that the American contractors basically are, this is, I guess what you're saying is, this is their forum where they make their connections to make sure that Turkey buys American planes with American dollars, and specifically from their corporations, and that kind of networking, right?
Exactly, exactly. And there's a Turkish component there as well, in terms of the membership at the ATC.
Yeah, but what's criminal about that, Luke? I mean, this is the American way, buddy.
There's nothing criminal about that per se. Although there was an article in Vanity Fair by David Rose last year called An Inconvenient Patriot, a 10-page article about the Savelle story, where the ATC is described as a front activity. So it's not so much what the, you know, there are ostensibly appropriate activities going on there, and there are also a bunch of illegal activities that are operating under the guise of the ATC, according to Vanity Fair and a few other articles that we can point to.
And what kind of illegal activities are we talking about then?
Well, first, it's important to understand, or to have a better understanding of Turkey, just so that we can appreciate what's going on at the ATC. Turkey is ruled by a governing elite that's known as deep state in Turkey, which is basically a collection of drug dealers, the Turkish military, Turkish police, and the ostensibly elected politicians. The reason we know about the Turkish deep state is because there was a car crash a decade ago in 1996 at a place called Susurluk. Are you familiar with Susurluk?
No, not at all.
It sort of blew apart the entire deep state, exposed it for everyone to see. It was a car crash in the middle of the night at a place called Susurluk, and Susurluk is now the shorthand, really, for explaining the Turkish deep state.
I think I do remember a little something about this. All the different people in the car were people who should not have all been in the same car together. Is that right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And who was it?
They refer to it now as Turkey's Watergate. There was an MP, police chief, a beauty queen who was also an assassin, and her lover, who was a top Turkish gangster and hitman. His name's Abdullah Catley.
I think I've seen that movie.
Right. It's a bit of a joke. But it sounds like a joke. And in the car they found, all these machine guns and whatnot, plus false diplomatic passports for, the terrorists and the drug traffickers, and it was a real mess. Someone gave an American analogy. He said, imagine a car accident at a hotel in West Virginia. Several people are killed, including, say, Jeff Gannon, Doug Cease, Warren Christopher, and Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
that's sort of the equivalent. I told Sabelle that once. She thought it was hysterical.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is that the regime in Turkey is no less corrupt than the regime in the United States, and that basically military thugs run the place, dope dealers run the place, right?
Right.
And not the good kind of dope. Right. We're talking heroin here.
Heroin. Oh, Turkey is the major transit point for Afghanistan's heroin. Yeah. A lot of it goes through, 5 tons a week or something.
Now, I remember, Luke, in the 1990s, that Bill Clinton took the side of the Kosovo Liberation Army, which were nothing but basically Osama bin Laden-tied narco-terrorists in Kosovo. Is that not right?
That is correct.
And now, is this is that same pipeline of drugs that they talked about back then, right? The Golden Crescent, where it's all grown in Afghanistan, and then it ships across Central Asia into Southern and Central Europe, and up through Bosnia and to the rest of Western Europe and the United States, right?
Correct, except you left out Turkey.
Well, yeah.
Like 90% of it goes through Turkey.
That's the bridge between the Central Europe and Central Asia there.
Right. It is either blessed or cursed by geography, that's for sure.
Well, and, part of that is that, part of the result of that geography, I guess, is that the Turks are, in a way, kind of Western. As previously mentioned, they're members of the NATO alliance. They're extremely friendly with the Israeli government. And even though they're a Muslim country, they're kind of, in the bridge, figuratively in this case, between East and West, right?
Right, exactly.
So no matter who you are, if you're the Arab powers, or if you're Israel or the United States or the European Union or Afghanistani drug lords, it's all about Turkey, really.
It's all about Turkey. And the Turkish military and the MIT, which is the intelligence operation there, the intelligence agency there, pretty much know exactly what's going on. I'm not sure it would be right to call it a police state, but when you're moving that sort of amount of heroin through the place, they're basically in control, aware of and in control of and actively participating in the distribution of heroin through the place, through the country.
Didn't you tell me that the Turkish generals are even really in control of the drug trade all the way back to Afghanistan? It's not like they're just receiving it in Turkey, that they're basically in charge of the whole operation from the poppy field on?
Perhaps not from the poppy field. Yeah, well, not from the farmers directly, but, one or two levels above, the small aggregators that run around and collect the stuff from the farmers, yeah.
But on the ground in Afghanistan?
As I understand it.
Yeah.
As I understand it. And then it either goes through Iran and Pakistan and into Turkey, or it goes up through Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and then around that way, and then into Turkey. And that's where all the wholesaling is done, and the manufacturing of the product and the packaging and the warehousing, all of it is done there in Turkey. Turkey supplies, I think, about 80% of all European heroin and 15% of American heroin.
How much money are we talking about every year?
That's $40 billion worth, more or less, at street prices.
$40 billion a year.
Right. So there's a fair margin in there for the people involved. And again, this is the deep, as we were saying, this is the deep state that controls this business.
How close is the tie then between these Turkish heroin dealing generals and, say, the American Turkish Council back here in the States?
Well, if we consider that the folks at the ATC in the US, sorry, the Turkish guys at the ATC in the US are basically the generals. They're the guys that are representing and dealing with the military industrial players like Lockheed Martin, etc. In other words, they're basically the same people. So that's where the ATC is basically a front organization that is running this heroin operation as well. And they're also dealing, and they're also being played by the military contractors. You know, Stil Giraldi, he's an ex-CIA agent. He used to work in Turkey. He used to be based in Ankara. He wrote a terrific article recently in the American Conservative magazine. Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, you've got to post it on your site.
Yeah, in fact, I actually interviewed Phil about the Sabella Edmonds, not exclusively, but that was one of the topics we covered in one interview before, yeah.
I'm not familiar with that, I don't think. In any case, he wrote an article about Sabella's case, I guess maybe 6 months ago, perhaps. Sabella said, this sums up her case very well. It nails it 100%. And Giraldi goes on to describe how, you know, Sabella's case provides an insight into how the neocons distort the U.S. foreign policy and enrich themselves at the same time. I was just going to say, and he talks about the way that the military-industrial complex and the neocons get together at places like the American-Turkish Council and deal with the Turkish general staff.
Right. Now, when I interviewed Sabella Edmonds before, she told me that she thought the AIPAC scandal and even like the Scooter Libby, Valerie Plame, and that her story, basically, we're all just one onion, and we just got to peel off the layers and figure out what's going on.
That's right. And I think the reason that she said that is because, as Phil Giraldi mentions in his article, you know, Richard Pearl and Doug Fife are literally agents of Turkey. They were registered lobbyists for them for 5 or so years. Now, Larry Franklin, of course, worked under Douglas Fife in his office there. So I think that's perhaps how she connects that AIPAC case. And similarly, you know, she basically says that AIPAC and ATC are essentially the same organization or have the same role with the same people. So I think that's part of the analogy that she's drawing there.
Now, which powerful Americans from the Bush administration whose names we'd recognize are members of this American-Turkish Council, Luke?
From the Bush administration? Well, there are a bunch of people at the ATC that, you know, cover generations. Brent Scowcroft is the chairman there. I can't really think off the top of my head who else is involved. Turkey has a bunch of, I think it's probably just about basically everyone.
Now, Pearl and Fife and Grossman and all those guys are members, right?
Grossman's a member. In Phil Giraldi's article, he talks about other friends, neocon friends of Turkey. I'm not sure how many of them are literally members of the ATC, but they all give speeches there, for example. He points to Pearl and Fife, as we've mentioned. Mark Grossman, as we've mentioned, Mark Grossman was a former number three at the State Department under Richard Armitage. Eric Edelman is there. He now has his old job as the Undersecretary for Defence Policy. Edelman was previously, in 2004 and 2005, the ambassador in Turkey. That's a role that Grossman also had in the past.
And now, wasn't Grossman this guy Douglas Dickerson, who he and his wife tried to recruit Sabella Edmonds, wasn't Mark Grossman his boss for a long period of time?
Yeah, in Ankara, in fact, when Grossman was the ambassador there in Turkey, Douglas Dickerson worked under him in weapons procurement. Dickerson was, in fact, suspected of being corrupt back in those days as well. There was an investigation into him, but they didn't go anywhere for one reason or other. And Dickerson went on to get promoted again and again. Same thing that seems to happen to a lot of these people. In fact, there are a couple of others that Giraldi mentions in his article. Paul Wolfowitz is now at the World Bank, as you know, and former Congressman Stephen Salaz. He's a lobbyist for Turkey as well.
Is it that you think, Luke, these people, Grossman, Fife, Pearl, that they're involved in, well, for example, dealing heroin and such?
Let me put it this way. The broad outline of Sabal's case that she's repeated again and again is that her case involves illegal arms trafficking, heroin smuggling, money laundering, and terrorist activity. And she says that you can't look at those elements separately. Basically, the same group of people involved in each of those different elements once you get high enough up the food chain. So if we take that as gospel, then guys like Peace and Pearl are involved in the heroin distribution, the heroin smuggling business at one level or other.
I'm imagining something like maybe they're doing some arms dealing and then the money's being laundered at the same place with a lot of drug money, and then a lot of that money's ending up in the hands of terrorists. Is it more direct than that?
Well, I'm sure they know how to keep their hands clean generally, yeah. But as Sabal says, it's those same people that are involved in each of those activities and are all at the core of her case. Exactly, you know, which task they have, you know, they personally have, I don't really know. But we know in Turkey, for example, it's all the same people. It's the Turkish deep state that's running the shop.
Well, one thing that we know, too, even though we haven't heard all that Sabal Edmonds has to say, we do know that the Department of Justice Inspector General's office says that she's telling the truth. And I believe senators are on the record as saying, well, they've heard what she has to say in private, you know, during secret session, and they believe every word of it.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason they believe it, they say, is because everyone at the FBI tells them that it's true, and because it's all documented, and they've seen the documents that back up exactly what she said.
Right. So this is all corroborated, even though we don't have our hands on it. By hearsay, we are to understand that it's corroborated, I guess.
Right, exactly. Exactly. One of my buddies, Miguel, wrote a post. I have a separate blog to the one you mentioned earlier called sabaledmonds.blogspot.com. And one of my buddies there wrote a post that you can see. It's almost at the top of the blog at the moment, called The Incredibly Credible Sabal. And he lists in that post all of the reasons, you know, why we should believe what she says, including, you know, and quotes from the two senators that she's dealt with the most, Senator Charles Grassley, a Republican, Senator Pat Leahy as well, have all verified her story. She's told her story, you know, to the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee, and also, of course, to the 9/11 Commission, all behind closed doors. And as you say, there's also the Inspector General's report and a bunch of other things. There's a new movie about Sabal's case, as you know, particularly the nuclear black market side of it, called Kill the Messenger. And in the movie, they talk to a former FBI veteran counterintelligence agent called John Cole, who was in charge of Afghanistan, Pakistan, you know, in charge of counterterrorism for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. And he tells the story that he heard about Sabal's case, and he investigated sort of internally with the FBI, and he says in the movie, says he's 100% accurate. So that's just another point of validation that's coming from him. Obviously, because she's gagged and because we have to sort of put the pieces together a little bit piecemeal, when you get my version of it, it might not be exactly the same as her version of it, because I sort of have to fill in the gaps a little bit. So I can't tell you what I'm telling you is 100% accurate, but everyone says that what she says is 100% accurate.
Well, Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, too, because, you know, this is the United States of America. And around here, the government is supposed to recognize that all human beings are naturally born with the right to say whatever the hell they want to. And the fact that the courts have invoked a state secrets privilege that exists nowhere in law, that is directly contrary to the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. That's why you and I are sitting here having to basically sound like a couple of conspiracy kooks connecting a bunch of disparate dots, is because we can't just ask her to tell us the story. They won't let her. They'll put her in prison if she does. They'll put her in prison for talking.
That's right. That's right. There have been a couple of good articles that have come out recently that do shed a lot of light on her case. One is the Phil Giraldi article that I mentioned earlier. As she said, it nails her case 100%. And the other is a two-part article that she wrote called Hijacking of a Nation. I recommend that people go and read that one. It's available, particularly the part two of it, which really lays out a lot of the things I've just been talking about in terms of, you know, the heroin dealing in Turkey. And she describes how, you know, why she basically lays out as much of her case as she can. So I really recommend people go and read. That's available at nswbc.org. I guess it's on the front page there. I'm not sure.
That's the National Security...
That's an organization, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, yeah.
Okay, and give that website one more time.
nswbc.org.
All right, and now what am I going to have to do to see a copy of Kill the Messenger, Luke? When is it playing in Austin, Texas?
You'll have to be patient, my friend. I'm sorry. I keep hearing that. I keep getting that request every day. Unfortunately, we don't really know, I don't really have a time frame for when it's going to be rolled out.
No, so it hasn't been.
I have a copy of it. It's terrific.
Oh, good. Has it already played in New York and D.C. and things like that?
It played a couple of weeks ago. Savelle had a private screening with a couple of whistleblower groups, etc. They had 100 people. In D.C., and they had a panel there after the movie with James Bamford, the directors of the movie, Robert Parry, and a couple of others, talking about, you know, how tragic it is that she can't say it, that she's gagged, and also discussing the appalling U.S. media that has been, you know, completely absent from her case and completely doesn't understand it as well.
Right, which is part of the reason why they haven't paid any attention, is because they don't have the slightest idea what it means. They don't know what to do with it.
I'm not exactly sure why they haven't touched her story. It might have something to do with the fact that it's or it might be similar to the fact that it's difficult to criticize, say, for example, Israel in the U.S. press. Similarly, it's difficult to criticize Turkey. The good news is that the U.S. media is going to get a chance to prove itself again.
And how's that?
There is likely to be some new information that's related to Savelle's case that will be released next week, as I understand it. Savelle tells me that it's newsworthy, so hopefully your famous media agrees and we'll actually see some articles about it. Although, heavens knows, given the way her story's been covered up so far, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we don't read anything about it.
Now, do you have any indication of what this news is about?
No. No. But as I said, she says it's going to be newsworthy. And she's going to... You talked about the, you know, her being gagged a minute ago. She's going to be... if there's any news media... coverage in the media next week, she's going to use that momentum on her case to announce a new call, a new petition for calling for her case to be reopened. She wants to have public open hearings in the Senate. And so that call will go out, I believe, in the next week or two. She has a lot of supporters that have signed up who want to, who all agree that should be brought out in the open.
Well, you can see how that would be problematic, Luke, if her story basically is that the United States is run by a bunch of terrorist financing heroin dealers.
That is a problem. that the truth is the truth, isn't it? As we discussed, he's already told a number of senators and committees, and they all, and including the 9/11 Commission, and they all know exactly what's going on. So we either have all of Congress knowing this and doing nothing, or we have open hearings and force some change.
That's kind of the way it happens with some of these stories, is they're too big to ever get into, because if you really got into it, you'd have to tear down the government of the United States and start over again.
Maybe that wouldn't be a bad thing, Scott.
Yeah, well, get no argument from me, pal. I know I'm not supposed to agree with foreigners about stuff like that, but what the hell, Luke? I don't know.
Well, Sabell's not a foreigner, and she, you know, she calls it treason, as you know. I think she's called it on treason on your show on more than one occasion. So if that's what's going on at the highest level, not in the State Department, if nothing's done about it, then, you know, the whole national security is at risk, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's a good segue somewhere in there to the Valerie Plame Joe Wilson connection to all this. What the hell do they have to do with the American-Turkish Council, Luke?
I believe Valerie Plame worked for an organization called Brewster Jennings, which is a CIA front company, as you know, that was doing, you know, due diligence, trying to work out what the hell's going on, particularly in relation to weapons of mass destruction. Brewster Jennings, going back to when Sabell was working at the FBI, and even going back years before then, as I understand it, probably back to 1996, were investigating the American-Turkish Council and Turkey. Valerie Plame went to Turkey a number of times. So the ATC was being scoped by Brewster Jennings, and I guess that's how they have all of these wiretaps and stuff that Sabell translated. You know, she only joined the FBI translation in, you know, just immediately after 9/11, as we just discussed. But 75% of the documents that she were, you know, from the archive, going back to 1996. So they have a whole body, you know, 5 years worth of information detailing, you know, all of these crimes that have been going on.
Now, didn't David Rose in the Vanity Fair article, didn't he verify with other agents that indeed there was this investigation that was the transcript she was reading were part of? And yes, it did go back into, you know, nearly to the mid-90s, and that investigation had been shut down for political reasons?
The investigation of the ATC? I'm not sure, Scott, but there was an investigation, you know, through 1996, 97, I think, where the FBI picked up all of this information about guys like Dennis Hastert.
Dennis Hastert, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives.
In 1999, Sabell says, they agreed to, Clinton tried to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate the case. The case was into Hastert and a few other people that we don't know specifically by name. That case was shut down in 2001 when Sabell started, you know, reporting her findings. I don't think that Clinton ever got around to appointing a special prosecutor because it was sort of at the time of the impeachment, as I understand it. And then, you know, then George Bush was elected, or became president at least, and Ashcroft shut down the case. The Hastert element is just one small part of the story. As I said earlier, the main parts of Sabell's story really are the weapons trafficking, which has really three components: the weapons trafficking and the heroin trafficking, and the money laundering and the terrorism, and where those things intersect. But I was just going to run through the specific claims that, because it sounds, you know, like a, when you put it in terms like that, it sounds like a pretty big puzzle for everyone to put the pieces together. But there are really three elements of the weapons trafficking, so we'll go through each of those.
Yeah, do that.
As we sort of mentioned earlier with the Giraldi article, there are, you know, there's a sort of what we call, I might call the, quote, legal weapons trafficking. We've got organizations like the ATC who are lobbying Congress to provide Turkey with, military funding. I think Turkey, in fact, is second only to Saudi Arabia in terms of access, in terms of military aid. Most of it comes in the form of grants from the U.S. taxpayer. I think 80% of it comes from the U.S. taxpayer.
Doesn't everything?
How do they do? Right, exactly. Now, Fidel talks a lot about the lobbying, you know, with former members of Congress and lobbying that goes on at the ATC. I suspect that a lot of the way that Turkey gets all of this military aid is because there are people at the ATC that are bribing congressmen, forcing them to vote for, you know, for these weapons. So that's the first one. The second one is that both Israel and Turkey, once they get U.S. weapons technology, they re-export it to other countries who aren't allowed to have U.S. technology. How they do that by, as Giraldi outlines, is that the defense ministries in both of those countries just create what he calls false end-user certificates. Basically says that, it's okay to get the technology from the U.S. and then sell it to countries like China and India and other countries that are ostensibly enemies of the U.S.
Now, do the Americans who are selling these weapons know that that's what's going to happen to them at the end?
I presume they know and don't care. I don't really know.
I see. Okay, and then now there's a third aspect too left, right?
Right, and this is the focus of the movie Kill the Messenger. That's the nuclear black market. And that has a couple of components. One, you know, we have... Fidel's case ties into the AQ Khan network for a number of different reasons. There's a company in New Jersey called Giza Technologies that are basically a supplier to the AQ Khan network. Tabell heard that apparently heard some wiretaps from these guys. The head of the organization, the CEO, a guy by the name of Zeki Billman, but he exported the stuff to I think they were detonators to South Africa. And the minute they got to South Africa, you know, his agent over there would turn around and send it to AQ Khan in Pakistan. So that's one problem. Now, this company, Giza Technologies, is still floating along completely, you know, without a hiccup. Tabell says, you know, it seems as though somebody wants to protect this guy and enable him to continue to sell these things into the AQ Khan network. He says business there is going, you know, great. They've just trusted boatloads of stuff going in every day to South Africa and Dubai, I think, and other places. But basically,
right, now,
feeds into the...
Now, let me stop you right there, Luke. For people who don't know anything about the AQ Khan network, basically what we're talking about is Pakistan's heroic rogue scientist, quote-unquote rogue scientist, ran this basically a nuclear black market ring from the late 1980s all the way through the early 1990s, and it's through him that the Iranians got a lot of their equipment and the Libyans as well, right?
Correct, and North Korea.
And North Korea, right, although North Korea never did enrich uranium with anything they got from him, despite all the accusations to the contrary. But still, so what you're saying is that American companies are involved in selling nuclear technology to countries where the technology is getting diverted immediately or was into this AQ Khan black market network, that ultimately American officials are in on this, bribed to look the other way and so forth. And America is putting nuclear weapons technology in the hands of our presumed enemies, basically.
Correct.
And now, is this why Sybil Edmonds is throwing around the word treason? Is she talking about, you know, these household names, these high-level people in the State and Defense Departments involved in this?
Well, again, yes, basically. the targets of AQ Khan, the clients of AQ Khan, as we mentioned, are the CPRK and Iran and Libya. They're the three that we know about, but it appears there are another eight different countries that were involved and a possible client. And so, you know, we don't really know, we don't publicly know at least, who else has got this technology.
Okay, now I know you haven't published it yet, and so I hope it's okay for me to mention that you told me you have a new interview with a former CIA guy stationed in Pakistan who's told you that the CIA and the American government knew all about AQ Khan all along. Luke, is that right?
That's correct.
Now, Richard, what does that mean, all along, starting when?
Starting from, I think, 1976, when
oh, AQ God, Khan, are you kidding me?
First stole his designs from in Holland.
AQ Khan first stole his designs from Holland in 1976, and at that point, the CIA began watching him?
Perhaps even before he first stole them, yeah. So, you know, it's problematic, but, you know, if you look at Sabell's case, we're seeing exactly the same thing. These guys, Giza Technologies, are supplying the network, and nobody does anything. And then we've got other companies who are major members of the ATC, major Turkish companies, who are literally manufacturing components for AQ Khan, and sending them either to Pakistan sending them to Pakistan via Dubai, where they just sort of repackage them and so that they can get past the import restriction.
Okay, now help me, Luke. Help tie me these things together here. This company in New Jersey, what does it have to do with the ATC or with these neocons?
I don't specifically know, other than Sabell overheard, heard wiretaps with the CEO of this company in New Jersey talking about exporting stuff to Pakistan to AQ Khan's network. And the CEO is still walking free.
I see.
So we have at least that information.
Right. And now, you're saying other companies are also involved in this that you can tie to the American Turkish Council. Is that right?
Correct. There are at least two companies. Sabell mentions them in her Hijacking of the Nation article, part two. One's called EKA, and I can't think of the name of the other one, but Sabell mentions them there, and mentions the guys. They're actually friends of AQ Khan. And, you know, they were shipping stuff to him, and they're shipping it straight to Libya. It was found in the Libya bust in 2003. And so, again, all this stuff has been going on for God knows how long, and the U.S. government is doing nothing.
Well,
I was just going to say there's a third element in the nuclear black market stuff that Sabell talks about, and that is Turkish companies placing doctoral students at the nuclear weapons labs, Los Alamos, I guess, and Sandia and whatever other, so that they can steal secrets.
Really? And this is something that she knows from overhearing on these FBI wiretaps?
I can only assume. I can only assume that's where she knows.
Didn't she only work as a contract employee for the FBI for just a few months? Did she just stumble right into the rat's nest or what?
It's a hell of a story, isn't it? I think the answer to that, you know, because she did uncover so much, some people are a bit skeptical that she could have possibly overheard, you know, all of that while she was there. But the reason why, as I understand it, the reason why she uncovered all of this important information is because the agents that she was dealing with knew that they were getting shoddy translations in the past. And so they pointed Sabell to particular documents where they expected, just by the participants in the phone call, for example, where they expected to find something significant. And when they got their translation in the first instance, you know, the translation said, oh, there's nothing important here. Let's say of a phone call between, I'm just using this as an example, Osama bin Laden and President Bush. And, you know, the agent would get it back saying, oh, there's nothing interesting here. They were just talking about having coffee or something.
Uh-huh.
And so the agent, so when Sabell got there, this was immediately after 9/11, so the agent were running around desperate to try and put the story together.
Right. These aren't the spin masters, the political agents at the top. These are the actual cops who want to solve a case.
Exactly. And Sabell says that they are all terrific.
And they turned to her and said, "Wow, you speak." They turned to her and said, "Wow, you speak all these languages. Help us out. Can you tell us what this says, what that says?" And she said, "Wow, I would have marked this important."
Exactly. In fact, this other woman that we were speaking about earlier, Malik Jan Dickerson, even before Sobel reported her to her boss as being, you know, as a possible espionage issue, the field agent that was working, I think his name's Dennis Thacker, had also complained about or suspected that Malik Jan Dickerson was involved in espionage. So for one reason or other, he knew that the stuff that she, the product that Dickerson was turning out was wrong. And so that's why, I presume, he pointed Sobel to it and said, "Hey, you better go and have a look at this because I think the stuff I'm getting is nonsense."
Now, is it the case that one of the things she overheard was a call from the American Turkish Council to American officials to have some 9/11 suspects safely removed from the country?
Yeah, there's a lot of people think that Sobel has the holy grail to 9/11, but that's not the case, according to her. She wrote a letter when the 9/11 Commission report came out, an open letter to Tom Keene and the Commission, and she says that basically all of the information that she knows about 9/11 is contained in that document. She outlines a few things. One is the, you know, the corruption there, the espionage involving Dickerson and her boss, Mike Fagali. Second thing that she mentioned in the open letter is the fact that the FBI had information in April of 2001 that they had an informer, long-term informer, who used to be an Iranian agent, I think an Iranian intelligence agent that was in charge of Afghanistan for a long time. The FBI had been using him for at least a decade. And he came in and gave the FBI this tip that Osama bin Laden, this is in April 2001, Osama bin Laden was planning a major terrorist attack in the United States, targeting four or five cities, said that the attack was going to involve airplanes, that some of the individuals in charge of carrying out this attack were already in place in the US, and that the attack was going to be carried out soon, in a few months. So they had all of this terrific information and did nothing with it, apparently.
Now, isn't that the case over and over again? Seems like the pile of leads leading to those hijackers was getting pretty thick by the time those planes crashed, doesn't it, Luke?
It certainly was. I do know that this information was passed off to Thomas Friels, at least at that level, immediately after the interview with this Iranian guy took place.
And now who's he?
I have to get that title for you. But I think he was the counterterrorism guy in Washington. I'm not really sure. You know, as I mentioned before, Sobel testified to the 9/11 Commission, and she told them all of this information, and none of it got in the report. The report, as I understand it, listed, you know, a bunch of missed opportunities, but they didn't include the fact that they were told that Osama bin Laden was about to use planes as weapons and hijack planes and use them as weapons in four or five cities in a few months, and that the hijackers were already in place. That's the sort of thing that sounds like a missed opportunity, right?
Sure does. And
so they didn't include that. And there was other information that they didn't include that Sobel reported to them.
And now what about that specifically about somebody at the ATC called Mark Grossman at the State Department and said, "Hey, I need you to spring my buddies from jail."
I think that's right. I'll have to check. It was either they called Mark Grossman. Again, I'm not sure. It was on a wiretap. I'm not sure whether it was a guy from the ATC necessarily, and I'm not, or perhaps it was some other targets that they were listening to. And it might have been a conversation between two targets that said, "Hey, well, we need to call Grossman and get him to spring our buddies." But basically, yes, there was three of their buddies, two Turkish guys and an Uzbeki, who were jailed immediately after 9/11 as presumably as suspects for one reason or other. And Grossman, because these guys requested it, Grossman called up whoever he needed to call up and got the guys out of jail immediately.
Well, now, Ashcroft rounded up all kinds of people. So is there anything that says that these guys actually knew anything or were in on any of this?
Not that I know. Apart from it's outrageous that Grossman can do that. You know, yeah. At the top of the hat.
Yeah, well.
And let me repeat, you know, they were these people that were having the conversation, the targets of the investigation. So they're not, you know, there's we can presume that there's at least some suspicion on them already. And they want to get their friends out of jail, you know, to be dodgy.
There was something about blueprints being sent overseas. Was that blueprints of the World Trade Center towers?
This is also from Sabell's article, from Sabell's open letter. In, I think, June of 2001, they had there was an Iranian guy who was a drug dealer. He was in jail for some drug charges. I'm not sure exactly what. And they were concerned, whoever was monitoring was concerned that he was involved with more than, you know, narcotics. So they're wiretapping his phone calls that he made from jail. He called one of his friends, as I understand it, and asked his buddy to send blueprints, pictures, and the details of the building composites, what the buildings are made of, and for a number of different skyscrapers, and send those blueprints to somewhere in the Middle East.
And did that include the World Trade Center towers?
I think the description that I have from Sabell is that the buildings were over 100 stories tall.
Okay, so there's not too many of those.
Right.
Well, so is she just being coy there? What, she's not, the gag order gets in between her and saying the names of the buildings?
I presume it does. I presume she would have told me.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. But there aren't, you know, as you say, there aren't many. I think Sears Tower's over 100 stories. But in any case, so this detail was being sent to the Middle East. And, you know, again, none of this information was included in the 9/11 commission report for one reason or other.
Right.
It's crazy.
All right. Well, we're pretty much out of time here. Is there anything really important I'm missing here, Luke?
I think that's about it, Scott. Other than as of next week, hopefully we can get everyone to support this new call for these new hearings. I'll have the details on my blog, of course, and I presume you will as well. I hope you will as well. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, well, I will, as long as you send me an email and remind me.
I certainly will. Hopefully we'll see it on the front page of the major newspapers in the country.
Everybody check out Luke Ryland's blog. It's whatisitgoodfor.com. He's got some really great analysis of all the news of the day there. Thank you very much, my Tasmanian friend.
All right, Scott. Thank you.